Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Shad here, your host for this weekend show. On this weekend show, we're going to be focusing a lot on the metals sector, especially the precious metals, making sense of the correction and now pretty strong rebound in the metals prices and a number of the stocks. This definitely isn't an environment where all the stocks are rebounding to the same degree. And you can make the argument in some cases that the metals are rebounding stronger than some of the stocks. So gives us a lot to talk about on this weekend show. And also a topic that we have been covering throughout the week through daily editorials, as well as discussing what's going on in some of the other markets, which seems like a bit more of a rebound now that the U.S. government is reopening. We are kicking off this weekend show with our good friend Matt Geiger. Matt is the managing partner at MJG Capital. We'll be talking more so on the equity front for precious metals, and also really asking Matt if he's been making any changes to his funds portfolio. Matt, let's start off with the whole concept of this precious metals pullback, now a bit of a rebound as we're recording this halfway through the week. We do have silver back above $50 an ounce. Gold has also rebounded, trading right around $4,200 an ounce. A couple strong days to start the week. A lot of people were asking the question, is this more than just a correction? Is the precious metals bull market over? This bounce probably has more people leaning on the side that says this could be just another continuation leg and a normal correction. But what does Matt Geiger have to say about it?
Oh, boy. Well, you're really putting me on the spot right to start the interview here. I mean, I will say first off, I think anybody telling you with full certainty that they know where the gold price is going to go in the short term here, you know, should be viewed with extreme skepticism. You know, with that said, if you're asking me to gaze into my crystal ball, my base case here, and again, I'm saying this with a low degree of confidence, is that we are well due for a correction, you know, probably of the magnitude of 6 months or so. I should emphasize, I am not of the view at all that this bull run in precious metals is over by any means. However, I think the confluence of a few factors that we've seen in recent weeks and in the past couple months suggests that the fun is probably over for the time being. So the first of these factors that I'll point to is really just the attention that gold and precious metals more generally started receiving going back to August, say pre-Beaver Creek, and really increasing through October. And this is by Western institutional investors, Western retail investors, and very notably the mainstream financial press. And, you know, anecdotally, you know, especially late September and into October, reminded me a lot of the, you know, Q3 2020 period, where personally I had childhood friends, you know, university classmates, some generalist fund managers even, you know, reach out to share their excitement about precious metals. And I even had a childhood friend, you know, talking about how well his silver call options were doing that he'd purchased in September. And, you know, while I'm happy for him and I'm happy for the enthusiasm, you know, emanating from generalist investors, you know, this type of excitement from non-mining types always makes me nervous. You know, a second point from a technical perspective, one can also look at the quarterly RSI on gold, which at October month end, you know, roughly matched the RSIs that we saw going all the way back to 1973 and 2008, which in those periods turned out to be short-term peaks in what proved to be longer-lasting precious metal bull markets. And then a third indicator, this is just a rough one, but was seeing silver reach, you know, $50 per ounce in mid-October for the first time going all the way back to 2011. And, you know, silver bulls will tell you how significant the $50 level is, you know, both from a technical and particularly from a psychological perspective. And this goes all the way back to the Hunt Brothers squeeze in 1980. And while I do ultimately expect silver to climb probably well above the $50 level before this precious metals bull market has formally concluded, you know, it just didn't seem to me that we would easily be able to slice through that level by any means. So those are the factors giving me caution here in the short term. You know, with that said, especially with the price action over the past few days, you know, I wouldn't be surprised at all to actually see the gold price sweep to all-time highs here in the coming few weeks. You know, maybe top out at around 4,500, just as a rough figure, and then formally enter this corrective phase that I was speaking about, or at least a consolidation phase, if you want to call it that, and maybe retreat back to the $4,000 level, or, you know, into the 3,000s for, you know, a good 4, 5, 6 month period, just to allow technicals and sentiment to reset before we're ready for another proper leg higher. So that's my best read on where we stand today.
Well, Matt, just following up on that idea, you know, as we talk today with gold above 4,200, with silver pretty close to an all-time high, just as we're speaking here, it's at 53.58 on the futures market. So 50 cents more, and we're at an all-time high in silver on a nominal terms. I know not inflation adjusted. But when I think about where we're at in the quarter, we're halfway through the quarter. We're mid-November here. The fourth quarter has had the highest prices we've ever seen in gold or silver on an average basis for the producers. Now, I know that we're going to normally talk about the juniors, but the producers are what's in the GDX and GDXJ, or the SIL and the SILJ. The producers are what the largest propensity of funds from generalists are garnering. And that's how a lot of people track the sentiment in the sector. Do you think that at this point that the gold equities or the silver equities are really factoring in these higher prices in Q4? Because it's a big jump from where Q3 was, which was a big jump from Q2. And I still don't see it being factored into the valuations.
I mean, I think you're right about that. Obviously, the precious metal producers have finally this year exhibited really excellent leverage to the gold price, you know, roughly 2x leverage to the, you know, 50-55% move that we've seen in gold year to date. You know, at the GDX and the GDXJ, up 120, up 130% in that general ballpark. So we've seen leverage, which is good, but they're coming off of such oversold levels that I think there is plenty of catch up to be done. With that said, that catch up does not have to occur in the next few months. You know, this could be a multi-year process of the market finally acknowledging that these higher precious metal prices are here to stay, and that reflecting in the valuations of the bigger guys. So if we do see this gold correction, you know, in the coming quarter or two, even though I do not think that current metal prices are factored into these companies' valuations, it wouldn't surprise me to see a general pullback amongst the larger producers as well. There of course will be exceptions, you know, those companies with specific catalysts that can drive a re-rating higher. I think M&A will only continue. Like, since we've seen this, you know, concern about a gold correction kind of going back to October 20th, we've had a handful of pretty big deals that have been announced in the subsequent period. I'm thinking about IAM Gold tying up Northern Superior, you know, the Fresnillo takeover of Probe Gold, and then of course the Core New Gold merger as well. So I still think the producers will track precious metals in the very short term, but if you're thinking out medium or long term, you know, we could just have gold stay flat at 4,000 for the next few years, and I think the producers could more than double from current levels over that period.
Matt, how do you go about analyzing some of the earnings that we're getting out of the majors? Because quite frankly, it's a consistent record revenue, record margins, record earnings, record cash flow, really across the board. But it was interesting to see as Q3 earnings started to come out, no matter what the headlines were, if gold was in a corrective phase that day, the stocks were getting hit. Now, understandably so, these stocks are much higher than where they were last quarter when they were reporting. So again, when we see these earnings reports, how would traders even play them when it does still seem like the big stocks, all the stocks are somewhat susceptible to what the metals price is doing in that shorter term period?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, to be frank, I'm not following the ins and outs of major earning releases as much as some of your other guests. And as you know, the MJG fund is thoroughly focused on the junior end of the spectrum. You know, every single one of our holdings, except for Altius Minerals, has a sub $1 billion market cap. Well, you know, with that said, in a general sense, I think all investors should be honed into the all-in sustaining costs that are being announced by the various producers. It's really the one thing that those companies have some control over to some degree. And so, the less cost creep we see really across the board, the better. And then from my self-interested perspective, I'm looking for hints that the bigger boys are shifting some of this, large amounts of free cash flow that's being generated, towards exploration. And that could either be, directly funded exploration carried out by the companies themselves, or, partnerships with smaller juniors. And I think we talked previously about Centerra as an example of one group that has really been at the forefront of, using their excess cash to get aggressive, back smart groups doing early stage exploration, and then let them do that work for Centerra. So I'm still looking for a broad-based shift towards exploration. I think it's coming. I don't think we've quite seen it yet. I think, debt pay downs, dividends, share buybacks for sure are currently being prioritized, but I think we slowly see that shift in the quarters and years ahead.
Well, Matt, just within your own portfolio, I know you focus more on the junior side of it than the producers, like you mentioned. So when you look at the explorers, when you look at the developers, I guess same kind of idea as the last question. Do you think the developers are really factoring in these higher metals prices or even the M&A deals that you just mentioned? Because, we looked at the Probe Gold takeover. It's If in US dollars, it's I think $56, $58 an ounce in the ground. The margins that these producers are making are $1,500 to $2,000. Why aren't development projects that are coming up with the next batch of mines getting above $100 or even $200 or $300 an ounce in the ground for these projects? Why are the M&A deals still so small? Why are the developers not factoring in these higher metals prices?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Probe Gold deal in particular, that was very cheap on a per ounce basis. I think we're talking, $55, $60 an ounce for the price that Fresnillo has offered. I will throw out the possibility of an interloper coming in and launching a competing bid. I think that's less likely than more likely, but if you look at the Probe share price, it's suggesting that at least some folks out there think that is a possibility in the coming weeks. Look, more generally, I mean, it's always a case-by-case basis. Certain development stage projects deserve very high premiums on a cost per ounce basis, just due to all the factors that one should look at, fundamentally. The grade, the depth, the metallurgy, the proximity to infrastructure, the size of the project. So there's nothing wrong with, disparities between specific development stage plays. But I think your broader point stands. We've definitely seen some trickle down, to the more junior end of the market. I'm not gonna say that we haven't, especially going back to August. It's been a good period for the juniors, and they've played some catch up to the big boys. But I don't think by any means anybody could say that especially the development stage names that you mentioned have gone too far too quickly. And I think at the current multiples that many of them are trading, they remain attractive M&A targets going forward.
So, Matt, since we're talking so much about valuations, I was talking to somebody earlier this week who runs his own book, and he made the comment that valuations are inherently arbitrary. And he says, look, the market is valuing assets at what it values it at. And when we look at such a wide range, whether we're talking majors, mid-tiers, juniors, and we're saying that most of the sector is undervalued, how do you go about analyzing what should get re-rated when you're kind of making the argument that the whole sector needs to get re-rated? This ties, I guess, more into how you're managing your portfolio because, look, if we're sitting here saying majors are undervalued, mid-tiers are undervalued, development plays are undervalued, what do you buy in this environment?
Yeah, I mean it's a difficult game. I'm not sure if this friend of yours was suggesting giving up on trying to value companies, because I would strongly suggest that that's not the way to go. I think each individual investor needs to have their own framework, but I think it's an extremely important process for any investor, and I'm speaking from a bottom-up fundamental perspective, to do your very best for each and every one of your holdings to come up with either an expected or a fair value for each of your investments, depending on the stage of the company. And of course, there's going to be wide variations, even for specific, for the same company amongst different investors. Like, a huge variable is what gold price are you assuming? Are you taking the more conservative route like the majors are and plugging in 26, 27, $2,800 gold when you're running your models or looking at the sensitivity analysis and feasibility and pre-feas and PEAs? Are you plugging in $3,500 gold, which is, a pretty decent delta from where we're trading currently? Or are you getting more aggressive and plugging in the spot prices? And I think that comes, down to each investor's individual preferences and outlook. But ultimately, even just from a relative perspective, I think it's important to have a framework for how you're thinking about valuations. And yes, it's possible that a rising tide will lift all boats. I mean, I think that's likely true if you're thinking, going out 2 to 3 years. But that doesn't mean that the gains will be evenly distributed. And I think if you're in this for the thrill of the hunt, you should be looking at the names that are going to provide that alpha or that outsized performance relative to the rest of the pack.
Well, Matt, within the MJG Capital Fund, are there any actions you've been taking in light of some of the price swings we've seen in the precious metals or in the base metals or critical minerals? Anything changing in your portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, in short, yes. Within the past month or two, we'll say, we have liquidated two precious metal focused investments entirely and have also taken profits on a couple others as well, especially in that run up in, late September and into late October, which I think was a great period for at least some profit taking. Our weighted exposure to precious metals as it stands, and this includes gold, silver, and I'm lumping in PGMs as well. It sits at roughly 30% of the overall portfolio as of the end of October, which, believe it or not, is actually our lowest exposure to precious metals going all the way back to 2018. This is not to say that we are staying away from new precious metal investments. I mean, if anything, I think relative to other investors in the space, we're quite underweight precious metals at the moment. So we have the opportunity to add a couple names where, most investors are very pregnant on PGs at the moment. And in fact, we just wrote a check to Ongwe Minerals. This is Hayadon's next deal, Namibia gold-focused explorer. I think we talked about the Headwater Gold financing that we participated in a couple months back. So we're still actively deploying to precious metal-focused names, no question. However, I don't think it's a bad time, for investors to look through their gold and silver juniors, particularly if they're looking at their mining portfolio and, 60 to 70% of the weighted portfolio is precious metal focused, and go through name by name and really think, first, is my investment thesis still firmly intact, first and foremost? And second, do I still think there's a significant disconnect between the current price and what I deem to be either fair or expected value? And I would say if the answer is not a resounding yes to both of those questions, it could be worth reevaluating whether to hold on to that position because there are plenty of fish in the sea. You guys well know there are, 3,000 of these juniors out there at this point between North America, Australia, and the rest of the world. Roughly half of them are precious metal focused in one form or another. So there's no shortage of opportunities. And then just going back to the MJG portfolio, we're still heavily overweight copper, as we discussed in our last conversation. And this is through investments in copper-focused developers, explorers, and heavy and prospect copper-focused prospect generators as well. So our weighting towards copper is a little bit higher even than since we last spoke, at around 46% of the overall portfolio. And we also now have a double-digit cash position within the fund, which is really a big shift from where we were, between really early 2024 up until April, May of this year, when we were fully deployed over that close to 18-month period. But I've made some effort, and it's been difficult, especially when you have the portfolio as a whole rising month after month after month. But I've made a concerted effort to bump our cash position up into the low teens where it currently sits.
Matt, thanks for sharing those numbers. Those really struck me here. So, just in summary, lowest exposure ever to precious metals, overweight copper, and you have built up cash. This is something we were talking about months ago. Also, with you, is that not a bad time to at least lock in some of your gains in the precious metals, but then Look, a lot of the shareholders or people, especially the precious metals bugs, are always touting about higher gold and silver prices. Silver could go to $100. Just think about how that changes their overall assessment of their silver stocks, even their gold stocks, if gold keeps running higher. What are you looking to do with your cash then? Are you going more into copper? Are you finding other metals that haven't gotten the exposure that the precious metals have? Because I think those numbers you shared with us are a very telling story.
Yeah, I mean, I would say broad strokes for the cash position, and this can be difficult to do, especially when there are so many opportunities, so many financings. Companies have been cashed up now for a number of months, and we're seeing a lot of news flow. We're seeing exciting drill results. Like, the space is really picking up in a positive way. But my goal here is to remain disciplined and largely hold that cash position, less concerned about a broader correction, specifically for commodities, but more concerned about the general markets and when we have that next, April 2025 like liquidity event, or the interest rate tantrum, going back to 2022. That will happen. I don't know if it's next month. I don't know if it's a year from now, but I think it's good discipline to hold on to a decent cash position, and so you have the conviction and courage to deploy it when that occurs. That of course won't stop us from making new investments in the intervening period. It will probably just be more of a one in, one out situation in terms of when we bring new holdings within the portfolio. But in terms of where else within the commodity space, I mean, I believe we touched on this a little bit in our last conversation, but I'd really hearken back again to Q3 2020. And that's when precious metals and precious metal equities peaked after their extremely powerful moves, out of the COVID lows from spring of 2020. And this temporary peak in precious metal prices did not spell doom for the rest of the metals complex and commodities more generally. In fact, it spurred a powerful, what turned out to be an over 18-month move, well into the spring of 2022 for basically all non-precious metal commodities. And we're talking energy, we're talking base metals, we're talking battery metals, ag minerals, really, you name it. And we're at a juncture now where basically all other metals are cheaper relative to gold than they were even in Q3 of 2020 when gold was at its short-term peak at that time. And copper is very much included. So that speaks to our confidence around copper at the moment. And so my strong suspicion, and I say this with a higher level of confidence than my crystal ball gazing in terms of the gold price moves in the short term here, but my strong suspicion is that we'll see some serious catch-up played by the rest of the metals complex. And this is really irrespective of whether precious metals are down, flat, or up in the coming months. And so I think if this does occur, the MJG portfolio is well positioned for that, with a good 60% of our portfolio exposed to non-precious metal mining equities as it stands.
Well, Matt, can we dive under the hood a little bit further into which ones are animating you? I know that for you, it's always a company by company basis. It's not the metal first, but there's things like the critical minerals, not just copper, which would be one, but I guess silver is now a critical mineral according to the U.S. as of last week. But I'm talking about things like the antimony, the tungsten, the rare earths. There's still lithium that could be coming off the basement. There's still uranium stocks. Any other metals that you're animated by?
Yeah, I guess I like the metals that haven't seen speculative furor in recent months. So I think that would exclude rare earths for the time being. I think that would exclude tungsten. I think that would exclude antimony. But I think the rest of the non-precious metal space is fair game. But as it comes to copper, like, I'm clearly very comfortable with that metal. And there's a number of reasons for that. The first is the incentive price. In order to bring the next generation of large-scale copper development projects online is probably in the low to mid $6 range at this point. It just keeps rising quarter on quarter. And so we'd have to have a good 25% potentially up to 30% move, from the current spot copper price before, kind of the median development stage copper project that has enough scale to matter really starts to make sense on paper. And, Brian Dalton, the CEO of Altius Minerals, a longtime holding of ours, someone I very much respect, harps on this. But his point is that if you look back to previous metal cycles, you will very often see the actual metal price move, 2x or more above the incentive price just due to the long lag times between when you press go on a project and before that new supply actually comes online. And that's even more true for copper because you're looking at, 4 to 5 years from a construction decision before these large scale, porphyry projects, actually have a chance of reaching nameplate production. And that's if construction is executed well. So I really like that perspective. And, another point I believe we've touched on previously, but if you're a junior, whether at the exploration stage or into the development stage, with a good copper project with enough scale to matter, there is simply no shortage of buyers out there. This, of course, includes the world's largest diversified miners, which have been vocal for years now that they're zeroing in on copper. It includes the largest Western gold producers, Newmont, Barrick, though maybe this will change with Bristow's exit. Even Agnico Eagle recently, they announced the spin out of all non-core equity stakes into a subsidiary called Avenir. But as part of that announcement, Agnico, clarified that their core focus is on gold and yes, copper. Those are the two metals that they're zeroing in on. And then, of course, you have at least a dozen Chinese parties that have been very aggressive on the M&A front. You have sovereign wealth funds. The list goes on. So I think it's a great opportunity to sell to larger parties. And then there's, of course, the supply disruptions. And just in the past 90 days, El Teniente, Constancia, Red Chris, QB, Mantoverde, and then, of course, Grasberg being the big one. And I think even though there has been a price reaction to these, shutdowns that have occurred one after another, seemingly on a weekly or biweekly basis, I don't think the market's factoring in the significance of these closures. And, we just had data come out from Morgan Stanley. I think it was early this week, maybe late last week. They're projecting the largest copper supply deficit in 22 years next year. So at least some folks out there are recognizing the significance of these supply cuts. So, for these reasons, clearly I like copper quite a bit, but as you alluded to in your answer, I will say that each of our eight copper-focused holdings, present upside on their own merits, from company-specific developments. This could be drilling, this could be permitting outcomes, this could be pending M&A, really independent of the copper price. But of course, a rising copper price would provide a welcome tailwind for each of these investments. I definitely can't deny that.
So, Matt, care to share maybe your top copper exposure? Or if you don't want to share stocks, I get that. Could you address the fact of a jurisdiction? Do you like the US because of some of the fast permitting action? And what sort of a resource? What size of a resource? Do you have a barometer of what a company broadly needs, you think, to get market attention or even that takeover attention?
Yeah, well, for copper, I mean, the kind of the line in the sand for the big boys is, 100,000 tons per annum. We have one company that's, right on that threshold. And it is one that I've written about publicly in the past couple MJG investor letters. So I'm comfortable speaking about that. And that's Corex Copper. That's Hayadon, Alan Friedman, and the whole or much of the Osino team, which had a very successful exit just last year. And yeah, they're pushing forward the Hay project in southern Namibia. I should be on site there in early February, which I'm very much looking forward to. But in terms of our copper holdings, that's the one that has the most leverage to the copper price. It is a relatively low-grade deposit that, of course, can cut both ways. But if you catch the cycle right, start plugging in $5.50, $6 copper, and the numbers there look pretty goofy. So that's probably the most directly levered play that we have to the price of copper. Lara Exploration's another name that I've written about for many investor letters in a row now. That's a holding of ours that goes back to 2019. I still classify them as a prospect generator, but you could very well argue that they're a development stage company at this point. You know, they're focused on their 100% owned PlanAlto project. They just put out a PEA there. Not the same scale as a Corex, I'll be the first to admit that, but a very tidy project in a jurisdiction where it is easy to mine. This is in the Carajás district. I was there a couple years ago. I visited PlanAlto itself. I also visited Bravo's Luanga project while in the region. And you know, this is mining central within Brazil. You know, there's recent M&A activity right near PlanAlto. You know, that includes the Turkish group Corex having bought BHP's, you know, non-core copper assets. That deal should close early next year. It's a lot of activity and a very good place to mine. So that's another company that I think has M&A potential. And then, yeah, I will say the rest of our copper names, you know, beyond Corex and Lara, you know, I would classify as either exploration stage or prospect generation. So, you know, you could argue those, well, one should argue those are less levered to the actual copper price. But of course, you know, a rising copper price will be a tailwind for those equity prices. That's just the way it works, you know, lowers our cost of capital for future financings as well.
Well, Matt, you mentioned a couple prospect generators in this call so far, not just Lara Exploration, but you also brought up Headwater Gold. I would submit there's a third one that I know that you follow, and we actually just talked to the company when we were in New Orleans for the conference last week, and that's Ridgeline Minerals. Saw Chad there at the CEO of Ridgeline Minerals, and they had a drill result that came out on November the 4th. And this ties into the theme we've been talking about here of beyond the precious metals. There's still some pretty exciting opportunities in the base metals. So they're going for a CRD system here. So it's got everything from zinc and silver to copper and lead. It's even got antimony in there and gold. So a blend of different metals, polymetallic. The market sold it off pretty hard, though. And I remember Chad just being puzzled that day, thinking, hey, you know, like this is a pretty exciting drill hit for us. And they're using a prospect generator model on some of their properties and then also using 100%, so kind of a hybrid model. Any thoughts there on Ridgeline Minerals?
I have a lot of thoughts. You opened Pandora's box there. I mean, we are Ridgeline shareholders, I believe, going back to 2021. You know, we've supported the company in multiple financings over the period since. First, it's obviously painful seeing the share price of a significant holding, and Ridgeline is a significant holding of ours. You know, seeing a share price decline 28% on the back of a single news release. You know, that's no fun at all. But it's also what, you know, those of us who invest in early stage mineral exploration have signed up for. It's, you know, it's the ropes. But, you know, I think it is worth noting that the Ridgeline share price, you know, more than doubled between, we'll say, mid to late August, you know, right up until those drill results were announced. And even after, you know, the precipitous decline that we saw last week, you know, the share price still sits at a level that is higher than it was, even going back to the beginning of, sorry, the end of September. So, you know, the story, the sky is not falling, you know, by any means from a Ridgeline shareholder perspective. In terms of the results, and look, I understand this may sound foolish to some, you know, given the market reaction, you know, to those drill results at Salina, but I actually found them quite encouraging. I did. You know, the first point is that this is genuinely a new discovery. Like Chad, Mike, and the rest of the Ridgeline team, like they've been searching for CRD massive sulfides at depth at Salina for years now. Hadn't found it, and they now have officially as of this drill program. And you know, whether or not this massive sulfide mineralization that's been intercepted, you know, proves to be economic at these depths, like that's another question. But for starters, we now know that it is definitively there. I'd say the second point, like this drilling wholly validates the geological model that was generated by Ridgeline and South32 earlier this year. Like, remember this target that they're drilling, it's brand new and it's never before been tested, at least before this drill program. And the model that the joint technical teams came up with has now been validated with these results. You know, this, of course, is not a small target either. Like we're talking, you know, roughly 2 kilometers laterally from side to side. So It is hard to say that it's been properly tested with assays in hand, from only a hole and a half. And I'd say the third point, and perhaps most importantly from my perspective, like South32, the earn-in partner, appears enthused by these results. Like some of your listeners that are following Ridgeline closely, may have seen South32's chief development officer post on LinkedIn, on the day, I think the day after the Ridgeline news release. And first, he compared Selena to Hermosa Taylor, which is the world's largest CRD deposit currently under development by South32. So that's no small comparison by any means. But then more importantly, he said, quote, "We're excited to advance this project in the months and years ahead." And, as you noted, I'm a big believer in the prospect generator model. And really, all one can ask for with this model is for continued partner expenditures at a given asset. And these comments, to me at least, suggest that South32 is eager to hit this target hard next year, really irrespective of the assays that remain from this program. We've got another, hole and a half, hole and a third to go. So big picture, like we did not get the proverbial, quote unquote, "this will be a mine discovery intercept." I'll be the first to concede that. And clearly some in the market were hoping for that, given, judging by the share price reaction. But I do think there was a lot to be encouraged by. And really my litmus test for whether this program, should ultimately be deemed a success will be whether South32 commits, to at least a similarly sized and hopefully larger drill program in 2026, which could in theory start, in April, maybe late April, as soon as the snow melts. And then of course, in the meantime, there are still assays pending from the remainder of hole 53 and also hole 54, which will be going through kind of the heart of the target. So, it's worth staying tuned for that as well.
All right, Matt, we will wrap it up here. As always, so interesting hearing what you're doing with your portfolio and some of the moves that you have made to build up cash. I think everyone should take note of, look, you're a fund manager. You hear from all these companies. You need to manage this portfolio actively, and you are doing that. So again, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us on our weekend show. Again, Matt Geiger is the managing partner at MJG Capital. Click the link in the show notes to visit the MJG Capital website, read over some of the missives that Matt puts out to everyone that follows along. Everyone, stick around. We are going to be right back, continuing to talk markets and metals.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.